Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, watch out for a crash on the 101 westbound. It's slowing traffic right at the State Route 51. Elsewhere, accidents 101 northbound in the East Valley on the Indian School exit ramp and on the I-10 westbound at Ray. Sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 96. Clear tonight, overnight lows near 70. Sunny and 99 tomorrow, up to 103 on Sunday. It's 95 degrees right now.
Business, education, and community leaders joined Governor Doug Ducey today to announce a new initiative to boost workforce training and educational achievement. It's called Achieve 60 AZ. And KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes joins me to share the details. Christina, what's the significance of the number 60?
Well, 60 is a percentage goal. By the year 2030, this group wants to see 60% of Arizona adults hold a college degree or post-secondary school certificate, which basically means completing specialized job training or education beyond high school.
So 60% is the goal, but why that number? And for context, where are we at today?
The coalition behind this initiative says Arizona's current educational attainment rate is 42%. Now, that's the percentage of 25 to 64-year-olds with at least a certificate, associate's, or bachelor's degree. Certainly, educators think 42% is low. And lately, we've been hearing more politicians and business leaders backing them up. And here's why. A Georgetown University study found that by 2020, nearly 70% of jobs will require some kind of training beyond high school.
The coalition unveiled its plan today. How are they going to reach that 60% goal?
Well, no one revealed a specific list of actions today. They say those will come as the coalition continues to work. But they did announce four areas of focus. One is strengthening the K-12 pipeline to increase high school graduation rates and college readiness. Another focus is on getting Arizonans to finish their certificates or college degrees. You know, sometimes people end up dropping out for different reasons, so they want to find ways to get them back into the classroom.
And when you say classroom, you don't necessarily mean driving to a school, sitting in front of a teacher with the PowerPoint lecture.
Right. Classrooms can be anywhere. For example, in Avondale, at Universal Technical Institute, known as UTI, many classrooms are actually garages. That's because they train technicians for the transportation industry. And that's another focus of this initiative, to support workforce needs and close the skills gap. Here's UTI President Michael Romano.
Jobs are out there. Stable jobs. High-paying jobs. Jobs with benefits. But you have to be ready for those jobs. You have to have the training and skills required to be successful.
The fourth area of focus is what they've dubbed increasing access, raising awareness about education beyond high school and making it more affordable. That was a point stressed by Dr. Maria Harper Marinick. She's chancellor of the Maricopa Community Colleges.
So we have invested great effort to maintain access for all people without compromising academic quality and support services, even when resources became, for some of us, very limited. But we understand that we need to do more.
And she says they're ready, along with more than 60 community, business, and philanthropic leaders who will work on specific strategies and tactics to reach that 60% goal by 2030.
And Arizona's not the only state setting these kinds of goals, right?
Yeah, I'm told more than 30 states have similar goals. While it sounds like an education issue, it's just as much about economics and social issues. According to this coalition, if Arizona reaches the 60% goal of post-high school education, we could see an extra $3.5 billion in personal income and tax revenue into the state every year.
KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes, thank you.
You're welcome.
The State Department of Education has released the final results from the second year of AZ merit testing. That's the standardized English and math test that replaced AIMS. And while they show some improvement from last year, the majority of students are not passing the test and do not score in either the proficient or highly proficient range in either subject. With me to discuss the results is Pearl Chang Esau, president and CEO of the education group Expect More Arizona. And Pearl, first off, what do you think about these final results?
What we see in the second year of results is some modest improvements. We were happy to see, generally across the board, in almost all grades, an improvement in both subject areas. And we also saw some increases in closing the achievement gap. But overall, you know, the results still show that we have a long way to go. We have still more than half of our students who are not considered proficient on the AZ Merit assessment. And one important piece of context about that is that the AZ Merit is a lot more difficult than the assessment before it. And that's important to note because we should, I think, first acknowledge that it was the right thing to do to introduce a more rigorous assessment. That's going to be a better indicator of whether our students are really on track. And as students get used to the new assessment, you know, it's going to take a little bit of time to adjust. And we're certainly seeing that in the scores.
Well, even before students started taking AZ Merit, folks in the education world, yourself included, were warning people saying, hey, look, we know that scores are going to go down. It might look kind of ugly for a little bit. Did you think that this is how it would look?
It is actually what we expected to see. When we look at the national assessment of education progress, which is considered the gold standard of testing, and it compares states to each other, those were the kinds of numbers that we were already seeing for Arizona. I think really positive news, though, is that when you look at those national assessments, you do see that Arizona is actually leading the pack right now in improvements.
How do you try to sort of filter out, when you look at these numbers, how much of the results are the result of students getting used to the test, getting used to more rigorous and new standards, and how much of it is just that students aren't maybe learning everything they need to do and maybe some more tweaks need to be made?
I think we would have to say it's both. There is definitely some element of adjustment going on here. It's gone from a kind of a rote memorization test to a critical thinking problem-solving test. But then at the same time, you know, it is also true that our students, if you look at them as a whole, if you look at the overall average score, they're not where we want them to be. Now, you have to dig a little bit deeper into the data to see that actually we have some students in some schools that are doing really well, but there's a pretty big achievement gap.
When you're looking at trying to raise these numbers, especially in the proficient and highly proficient categories, how much of that is just sort of a waiting game where you have to allow the students to get used to the new standards and get used to the new format of the test? And how much of it is maybe things that need to be changed a little bit in the classroom, maybe different priorities here or there, maybe more money, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, we always look at the big goal, which is that for the jobs of today and even in the near future, we know that almost all jobs are going to require more than a high school diploma. And that really means that the goal for our entire education system has been elevated. So in that sense, there's a really big shift that needs to occur. Some of the things, for example, that we look at in Arizona are we need to significantly improve access to early, high-quality early education. We're currently right now having an issue with teacher retention. And then we also want to make sure that we are helping every child read proficiently by the time they're in the third grade. You know, that's when you look at the third grade reading scores, that's probably one of the areas of greatest concern is that we have a majority of our students in the third grade who still would not be classified as proficient. And then we need to look at what's working because there are examples of things that are going well in our state. And I think that as we go forth in creating policies to support improving student outcomes, we need to learn from what's actually working on the ground.
Pearl Chang-Esau is president and CEO of the group Expect More Arizona. Pearl, thanks as always.
Thank you so much, Mark. Good talk with you.
Roosevelt Row is one of the most vibrant parts of downtown Phoenix. It's helped spur the redevelopment of the city center in recent years. But now the Arts District is in the middle of a controversy that keeps ramping up.
I like to talk with some friends and colleagues about the critically important difference between politics and policy, and this is, I think, an example of politics preempting policy.
Greg Esser is the executive director of the Roosevelt Row Community Development Corporation and one of the community leaders who's been pushing for the creation of a business improvement district in the area. It would tax the district's property owners to cover services beyond what the city normally provides. But in response, the state legislature passed a law effectively blocking the creation of the business district in Roosevelt Row. The show's Lauren Gilger caught up with Esser this week after the city filed a lawsuit to fight that new law, and she joins us now with more on all of this. And Lauren, there's all this controversy, but a business improvement district isn't exactly a new idea.
No, it's not. There are many others around the state. There's even another one in downtown Phoenix. These districts cover things like landscape maintenance and security. And when I met Esser at DeSoto Central Market on Roosevelt Row earlier this week, he said those things are going to be more and more important in the future, given the number of new residents that are about to live in new housing developments that are being built there now.
Sadly, there are a number of new plants that were recently installed in the area that are stressed and starting to die because of lack of maintenance. Picking up garbage, providing garbage receptacles in the right-of-way is one of the critically important services. I pick up garbage when I walk in the neighborhood today. I can't do that when there are 1,000 new people living in this area that don't have somewhere to put their garbage.
But then the legislature got involved.
Right. So the city council did approve the creation of the business district in January after some heated debate, and some property owners in the area were not happy about it. I also caught up with Phoenix City Councilman Jim Waring outside of an event he was attending, and he said many of those property owners came to him with their complaints.
There were a whole host of people who were saying, that's not fair. Nobody asked me, or that's not fair. I didn't understand the implications. Nobody really contacted me. I do not blame the citizens for being mad and going to the state legislature and asking for redress there, which they got. Bill passed. Governor Ducey signed it.
So where does this leave us now?
Right. So it's not over. The governor signed the bill blocking that district into law. And what it did was change the requirements needed to form business improvement districts all across the state. You used to be able to go forward with one of these districts unless half of the area's property owners submitted a protest. Now it's the other way around. You'd have to get a petition of support signed by more than half of the landowners in the area in order to make a new business improvement district. Esser said that's obviously much harder to achieve, but to Waring, that's the point.
In my mind, you're talking about taking people's money, and so if it is going to be skewed one way or another, shouldn't it be skewed more to the, I'm conservative, I'm a Republican, so I'm saying more towards not taking money unless you're absolutely sure that most people are okay with this.
So the city decided to sue over this new law.
They did. The city sent me a statement about it. They said they're cautious about commenting on active litigation, but they're seeking a declaratory judgment finding the law unconstitutional and unenforceable.
So where do we go from here?
Well, Esser says they'll win in the end because he thinks they have the majority of property owners in the area on their side. And to him, this is really all about community.
The quality of this place has been largely defined by artists and people in the cultural community really calling this home and making long-term investments. And some of them, like Trinity Cathedrals, Phoenix Chorale, Phoenix Center for the Arts, have been here for over 40 years. So the flashpoint is interesting only in that it was a quick, rapid response in opposition to a long-term community investment that's continuing regardless of what happens with the lawsuit or with a change at the legislature. This work will be ongoing regardless.
The show's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
A new article in Vanity Fair follows up on extensive reporting in the Wall Street Journal and hammers Theranos, a Silicon Valley-based high-tech lab and testing company. In 2013, Arizona became a comfortable landing spot for Theranos wellness centers that were opened in Walgreens stores. Then in 2015, after a unanimous vote by members of the Arizona House, the company's footprint was growing. The bill, HB 2645, gave the public the opportunity to order any clinical test from a licensed lab without getting a doctor's prescription. Theranos CEO Elizabeth Holmes was in town when Governor Doug Ducey signed the legislation.
This historic law will help show that a healthcare system based on prevention, transparency, and individual liberty, giving people access to the information they're entitled to and they need to live healthier and longer lives, is the future of healthcare.
But some of what Theranos promised with its fingerstick blood testing methods didn't pan out, and the company has faced harsh criticism and penalties for Holmes. Former director of the Arizona Department of Health Services, Will Humble, was at the helm when the wellness centers were open and joins me to talk more about Theranos and the related legislation. Will, what appealed to you about Theranos' initial venture into Arizona?
Oh, when I first heard about the partnership between Theranos and Walgreens back in 2013, I was enthusiastic, and you might even call me an evangelist about it. You know, there was a couple of things I really liked and actually still like about the opportunities that were in that 2013 arrangement. Number one is, this shift to being able to go from a venous draw or a venipuncture to just a fingerstick type method. To me, that if that technology can get really squared away and be accurate, I think it has a way, it would have the potential of really transforming how we do laboratory testing, at least for, you know, many of the kinds of the tests that patients need.
At this point, what do you think the finger stick method is best for?
It's been good for lead testing, lead poisoning testing in kids for a long time. So that, for actually at least 10 or 15 years. So that was a technology that really transformed the way we did lead poisoning testing throughout in the mid part of my career in public health. Now, I think the kinds of tests where a finger stick method at a retail location would be really valuable for are the kinds of simple tests that allow patients to do what we call chronic disease self-management, way testing that folks need to do to follow up on whether the things that they're doing to manage their condition are working. So, for example, if you've got a history of lipids that are too high, cholesterol readings that aren't right, and you're on either medications or diet changes, et cetera, to help manage that condition, one of the things that you need to do to make sure that, what you're you know, your diet's working, the medication's working, is to follow up with periodic testing. If you can make that convenient and simple, and by the way, make it as a finger stick rather than a venous draw, people are going to be more likely to do that. And that helps provide for, you know, a more immediate feedback loop for patients and helps them manage their condition more easily.
Will, after you left the health department, there was HB 2645, which passed unanimously in the House and was only opposed by the Arizona Medical Association. It had with had to do with deregulating this idea that the doctors had to give a prescription in order for someone to go get a blood draw. Does the fact that there was some bumpiness related to this and the fact that the company that was coming out here to lobby and was standing there with Governor Ducey, for example, should that cause more complications in the thought process?
I don't see that as a problem. That's I'm just speaking for myself personally. I mean, if you look at the core issue here, I mean, it's really a public policy question that was being asked is, hey, you know, should folks be able to get tests without going to their doctors first to get a prescription, right, for some kinds of laboratory testing? You know, the bill you're talking about was really surrounding that question. And while most people think of that as being about Theranos, it actually applies to other tests. I know there's some other, I think Sonora has some tests that are available without a prescription, the venipuncture, you know. But so really the public policy question is, should we give Arizonans more direct access to being able to get laboratory testing done? And the answer, I think, was a unanimous yes within the legislative body. The issue that came up subsequently is the finger stick method as accurate as it needs to be. And the way I look at it is that the regulatory system worked.
Will Humble is the former director of the Arizona Department of Health Services and is currently a division director at the U of A's Center for Population Science and Discovery.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Steve Goldstein. There are over 15 million DNA profiles in the FBI's National DNA Index. They've been building it since 1998. And it won't surprise you to know the FBI, even local police, collect DNA swabs when someone is arrested or suspected of a crime, just like fingerprints.
But then imagine this. Five teenagers sitting in a car in Melbourne, Florida. A cop pulls up and asks what they're up to, and then asks which one of the boys wants to give a DNA sample.
One of the boys consents and gives the cops his DNA. No crime has been committed, and no crime is even suspected here. The cops hold on to that DNA and store it in a private facility.
What you just heard is a true story. You can find out about it at ProPublica.
It's happening more and more in local police jurisdictions all over America. As police build local banks of DNA from people they arrest, but often from people they don't arrest. And that raises important questions, not just about who's regulating and setting rules for these databases, but also why are the police collecting information on people who aren't suspected of crimes? Frederick Heron is director of public safety of the Bensalem Police Department in Bensalem Township, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. His department started creating its own DNA database in 2010, and he joins me now. Fred, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining me, Stephen Mercer, Chief Attorney for the Forensics Division of the Maryland Office of the Public Defender. He's been involved in state and federal cases about local DNA collection. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Todd.
So, Fred Herron, how do these locally collected databases actually work in your community?
What we're doing, we started in 2010, is when we have someone arrested for a crime or someone we suspect of a crime, we will ask them consensually for their DNA. We have about a 94% compliance rate where people give up their DNA. Why they do it, I don't know, but it's the same way. Why does someone give us consent to search the trunk of the car when they know they have 7 kilos of cocaine in the back? I don't know, but I've been in law enforcement for 30 years, and they've been doing it for 30 years. And unless the United States Supreme Court tells me to stop, I'm going to continue to do it.
All right, Stephen Mercer, how does this sound to you? Is this a lot of concern about DNA? And if we called it JFK, people would feel better about it? Or do you see a problem here?
There's a real concern, and here's why. As Mr. Herron was explaining, there is no set rule. It is in the hands of the officer on the street who's exercising discretion about who to collect DNA from. That level of discretion, without any guidance from regulations or protections or reporting requirements, what we see and what's been the experience of the public defender is that the usual suspects are targeted. And so we see this amplification of the biases in the criminal justice system along the lines of race being amplified through these types of unbridled collection program. And since the dawn of DNA databanks, if there's been one thing that there's been general agreement on, is that given the vast potential for abuse of DNA and the profound privacy implications that are at stake, the close regulation and constitutional scrutiny of the government amassing the DNA of its citizenry is essential. And we're talking about DNA of innocent people here.
Fred Herron, Stephen Mercer is raising one of the key points here, which is the FBI database, which I mentioned at the top of our conversation, is, of course, governed by federal regulations. There are lots of rules about how that database is operated, chain of custody, and everything else. In your jurisdiction and many other states around the country, those regulations don't apply, and the rules are different everywhere you go.
Well, a couple of things here. He's a defense attorney, so of course he's going to take that stand, and I'm going to take my stand, and that's what makes this country great. And leave it to someone from Maryland to bring up a race issue. That is not the issue here. I don't know where we jump from DNA to race, but we do not have a disproportionate, and I don't have those numbers, but I can certainly get it back to you. It is not primarily African-American or Hispanic database. That's just a ludicrous statement. But going back to what you were saying about the FBI, they have CODIS. Which is the federal database, what governs the three different databases, a local, a state, and ENDIS, a national database. In Pennsylvania, if I was to submit DNA from a crime, from a property crime incident, I mean burglary, theft, it takes over 18 months to get those results. That's not acceptable. Right now, I'm doing it in less than 30 days. It takes sexual assault, rape, 7 months in Pennsylvania to process. I can get it back. I have a job right now. I'm getting the results back tomorrow. We submitted it 2 days ago. I'm getting the results back tomorrow. Plus, Bensdale Township, what you said is officers are out there on their own. We have strict rules and regulations regarding the collection of DNA. We are state certified. We are state accredited, and we are finishing our national CLIA accreditation, which we should get accredited in November. So it's not a rogue cop out there just like with a swab of a Q-tip collecting DNA.
Well, you can hear some of the controversy that's embedded in the collection of DNA. Fred Herron, Director of Public Safety of the Bensalem Police Department in Pennsylvania. Fred, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Stephen Mercer, Chief Attorney for the Forensics Division of the Maryland Office of the Public Defender. Stephen, thanks.
Thank you.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway.
Arizona Corporation Commissioner Bob Burns will get a commission-funded attorney to defend himself against a lawsuit filed by APS. His fellow commissioners approved spending the money yesterday after a sometimes testy meeting. KJZZ's Will Stone was listening in, and he joins me. And Will, what exactly did the commission ultimately decide?
After a lengthy discussion, Mark, they decided 4-1 in a vote to use commission funds to hire an outside attorney to defend Commissioner Bob Burns in his lawsuit. If folks remember, Burns has been the standard bearer of the fight to force APS, or its parent company, Pinnacle West, to disclose whether it was behind about $3 million in so-called dark money spending to help get current commissioners, Doug Little and Tom Farese, elected during the 2014 election cycle. He has subpoenaed the company, and they have in turn sued him back, calling his subpoenas unlawful. And now Burns, because of rules with the commission that say he is not allowed to use their in-house counsel, has to hire an outside attorney. And the question was, would his fellow commissioners get on board and greenlight the money?
And they did, but it sounds like it wasn't all, you know, lollipops and unicorns at this meeting. It sounds like there was some discussion about whether or not they should actually get on board and do this.
That's right, Mark. Burns found himself in the somewhat awkward position of having to convince his fellow commissioners, who were really against this lawsuit to begin with, to then, you know, approve the funds to fight APS in this whole matter. And so there was about an hour's worth of discussion, some executive session, closed session as well. But really, you heard most strongly from Little and Farese, who are the two people at the heart of this in terms of whether there was independent expenditures spent to support their campaigns. Little said he was deeply concerned about just writing a, quote, blank check to Burns, and said that the commission really hasn't budgeted for huge legal fees. There's speculation that this matter could go pretty high up, even to the Supreme Court. So there was a lot of discussion about that, whether they should put a cap on the legal fees. Tom Farese went actually further. He talked about APS's allegations in their correspondences with Burns that he's using this as a campaign tactic. Burns is trying to get reelected to the commission, after all. And Farese even suggested, hey, maybe you should go outside of the commission and get someone else, friends of your campaign, to start a legal fund and defend you. And that seemed to be a veiled reference to the solar industry, which has poured money through independent expenditures to support Burns's campaign so far. But ultimately, they decided to do away with the idea of a cap and promised to kind of re-examine the issue in about a month.
Will, you reference that Commissioner Burns is up for re-election. Was there any discussion of whether the commission would continue to pay these legal fees if Burns is not still a member of the commission as this case proceeds and potentially, as you say, goes up to the Supreme Court?
There actually was not discussion about that. I mean, initially, one of the commissioners said, well, perhaps we should put this off till after the election. But they decided ultimately that because there are upcoming court dates, Burns doesn't really have the luxury to kind of wait around about this. There was also discussion amongst the commissioners about a possible settlement in the matter, but there were no details about that really that came out. And there's no stay in the case, as we know.
It sounded like during the discussion, Commissioner Burns was talking about other legal cases that commissioners have faced and the fact that they did not have really limits on their legal representation. Did that seem to make an impact with any of his fellow panelists there?
It did, Mark. It seemed that after Bob Burns brought this up, Commissioner Tom Farese began to kind of say, well, okay, I see your point there. You have to remember the commission has really been embroiled in a number of scandals recently and has had a number of legal issues that have come up. And Bob Burns said, I approved the funds for those legal fights. Why wouldn't you do the same for me? And also, Commissioner Tobin said, we've never put a cap on anyone else before. Why would we do that to Bob Burns? And it seemed that eventually that may have won over some of the commissioners in supporting Bob Burns's need for a lawyer.
That's KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
What's the relationship between a salad on a New York City restaurant table and the ongoing drought here in the Southwest? A new first-of-its-kind effort will help explain. The Fusion Project will map the country's food, energy, and water systems and detail how they connect with each other. It's being funded by a $3 million grant from the National Science Foundation. Ben Ruddle, an associate professor in School of Informatics, Computing, and Cyber Systems at Northern Arizona University, is leading the project. And Ben, what exactly are you going to be doing on this?
Yeah, what we're doing is synthesizing and fusing a large number of data sets, both public and private, to create a comprehensive picture of the food, energy, and water systems in the United States. And that includes all of the connections of every community, every part of the economy, every business in the country, to other places in the country. Those are called teleconnections. And when you have teleconnections, that creates vulnerability, it creates opportunity. It means that everything we do is connected to something that's happening somewhere else. So we are mapping that network for the first time.
What's the importance of having people sort of understand how all those different things relate to each other?
I think that we live in an increasingly connected world, and because we're individuals, we have a limited perspective. What we're going to do with this information is to create visualizations that let people see and understand and visualize how they are connected to the rest of the world. This does a number of things for us. First, it's going to allow us to show people their footprints, their water use, energy use, use of land, impacts on pollution and greenhouse gases. And we can show people now where and how those impacts are happening, even if they're not in your own backyard. For example, it's very common for people around the United States to eat food that was grown in Southern Arizona or Central California. We're going to have maps of that now. So it's going to help people in New York City, for example, to understand and appreciate the water footprint and the dependency that's created in Southern Arizona and California.
How much do we know about these connections right now? I mean, are we trying to do research on that and then sort of produce the visualizations? Or is this just a matter of informing people about what we already know, putting it into a medium that people can really understand?
We actually know quite a bit about this system already, but it's only accessible to experts. And even experts in one field don't know what's going on in the others. So that's the problem. Our project is called Fusion for a reason. These data sets are currently not accessible in a unified way. So even though we can currently get a good understanding of any one part of the system, for example, the U.S. Department of Agriculture knows very well where our corn supply is grown and who uses it. The Department of Transportation knows very well what our train system and road system looks like and how it's used. And the Department of Energy has a good idea of where our power plants are and what the power grid looks like. But nobody has taken these data sets and lined them up in a way that gives us a systemic understanding of the complete food and energy and water system.
How quickly, reasonably, can we expect people to change their behaviors? For example, when, you know, maybe people in New York recognize what kind of water impact they're having by eating food grown in California, like how quickly can people change?
I think it's really slow. I think it's a generational process. We're playing a long game here. So when you're talking about providing education and public information, it can work its way into law. It can work its way into business practices. It can work its way into the way cities grow their economies and plan their economies in coming decades. And it can actually work to raise awareness and change public sentiment. But I don't think it happens quickly. You need to have a very patient and sustained approach to this type of thing. And one of the challenging things about this food, energy, water system is that it is an accumulation of many billions of decisions that people have made over the past 100 years in this country. We can, however, affect change by changing our connections and restructuring those. The flip side is that there can be some relatively quick change that happens if we can show large companies and our big sectors of the economy ways to improve their connections. So it's possible that in the private sector, we may see some quicker changes and some bigger improvements in the system's resilience to drought or to natural disasters as we start to produce this information. That's what I would anticipate, is that large companies will be the first to use this for good.
Ben Ruddle is an associate professor in NAU's School of Informatics, Computing, and Cyber Systems. We were talking about the Fusion project, which he is leading there. Ben, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
The jobs of tomorrow are here. You have to know the fields they're in, and you have to have what it takes to master those fields. Because you can't get the jobs of tomorrow until you get the skills of today. Start by calling ITT Technical Institute.
For 50 years, the ITT Technical Institute was a for-profit vocational school with 130 campuses around the country. All those campuses closed earlier this month, including four in Arizona. And since then, the Arizona State Board for Private Postsecondary Education has been trying to help about 1,200 students in the state who are left without a school.
The show's Annika Klein was at the first informational meeting for students last night. It was held at another for-profit school in Phoenix because the ITT campuses are completely empty.
The meeting was packed with more than 150 students in the main room and about 100 more in an overflow room and online, watching live from a webcam. And they've all been having a really stressful September.
So I was coming to my last quarter to get my associate's degree, and then it got shut down.
Virgil Wiley would have finished his associate's degree this November. A lot of students have similar stories of being just months away from a degree. Now students are worried about how to access grades and transcripts from a school that effectively no longer exists. The 800 number just gives callers a perpetual busy signal. Terry Stanfill is the executive director of the Arizona State Board for Private Postsecondary Education.
It is our understanding that the creditor seized all of their assets.
ITT Tech had kept on a skeleton staff to help students and faculty with the transition, but those staff were let go Wednesday. Stanfill is confident that they'll still get hold of the student records.
If you still have access to your student portal, get everything that you can out of that student portal when you go home tonight.
Students are repeatedly told during the meeting to get all the information they can off the ITT website. The room gets restless when one student says he's tried and hasn't been able to.
One of the things that we can do is...
There are also questions about who is eligible for loan forgiveness and why veterans won't get recoupment for GI Bill benefits. Out in the hall after the meeting, students are trying to look ahead. Some college representatives stand at tables with brochures and small giveaways, including reps from other private schools. Paul Mittman with the Private Postsecondary Board says closures don't happen often.
It's a very small percentage.
The board still licenses 238 other private schools in the state.
And so hopefully students don't paint everyone with the same broad brush, whether it's private not-for-profit or private for-profit.
Students can choose to transfer to another college, but the amount of credits that would come with them varies. Krista Bateman knows this because she tried to transfer credits to ITT.
And IT Tech said they would take my credits from Everest, which closed a couple years ago.
She had gone to Everest for 9 months when they shut down.
And they never took them, so I was a couple semesters away from graduating this one, and then they come out with the news that they're closing.
So Bateman figures this time it makes more sense to just have her student loans forgiven and start over. Because if she tries to transfer credits and only a few go through, the money will be gone.
Now I have to go back through, take a whole nother two-year degree, so that way I can go do the actual certificate program that I want to do again.
She wants to be a paralegal, but needs an associate's degree first, a process that in theory should take her 2 years. But at this point, it's looking like four. She says she'll probably go to a community college and try to finish as quickly as possible. One thing is clear. The next school she picks, she's doing her homework to make sure it isn't running the risk of closing down anytime soon. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
The Atlantic Coast Conference, or ACC, announced this week it would move its neutral site championships out of its home state of North Carolina this school year. The move is in response to the state's House Bill 2, which critics say limits civil rights protections for the LGBT community. This follows other groups pulling out of events in the state over this law, including the NBA and NCAA. To get a sense of the economic impact of these moves, I'm joined by Stephen Totten, a reporter with the Phoenix Business Journal. And Stephen, is it more significant that a hometown organization is taking the stand rather than out-of-state ones like the NCAA?
Yeah, absolutely, especially from North Carolina's standpoint. You know, you have things like the NCAA and the NBA, which are huge, huge institutions. But to have kind of a homegrown organization say, we can't do anything here, that's probably going to hit pretty hard to North Carolina.
Is that more of an economic hit as well, given that it's not some out-of-state entity coming in? It's a homegrown, a local company. They're a local organization.
Well, yeah. I mean, as far as local goes, you know, obviously the NBA and NCAA are going to generate a lot more money and revenue into the state. But the ACC, because it's local, is going that a lot of that money gets circulated back into the state. While the numbers may not be as large as something like the NCAA or NBA, just the fact that it is local probably is going to hurt North Carolina.
Do you see any parallels between what's happening now in North Carolina and what did happen in Arizona around SB 1070 and even earlier than that around the Martin Luther King holiday?
Yeah, I mean, Arizona does not have a scotch-free history when it comes to controversy like this with laws. I mean, SB 1070, of course, was a huge, huge hurt to the state. And I mean, we're still trying to kind of come back from that and regenerate our image. But the other thing was SB 1062 that came out a few years ago.
The Religious Freedom Bill is what supporters called it.
Yes, the Religious Freedom Bill, which, you know, critics saw as an anti-LGBT bill. And when that got passed, or when it was getting proposed, I should say, the NFL was threatening to not host a Super Bowl here. And then Governor Jim Brewer did veto it. But had that not happened, I mean, the Super Bowl generated millions and millions of dollars for the state. And we wouldn't have had that happened.
Is it difficult to really quantify economically how much these boycotts, if you want to call them that, cost? Because it's kind of like the old argument, you can never really tell how many lives a seatbelt saves because you can't count something that didn't happen. Is it difficult to quantify this because you can't really tell who didn't go to a given place because of something like that?
Yeah, I mean, even when you do have these events and you have these economic impacts, you know, they're not perfect. There are numbers that kind of get skewed. You know, there's a lot of people that will say this isn't the actual amount that got generated. But I think you can assume with an event like the Super Bowl or the Final Four, that's going to bring in a lot of money. I mean, I'm sure you remember when the Super Bowl was here in downtown Phoenix. You know, it looked like New York City. It was packed. There was people spending crazy amounts of money.
One of the discussions after SB 1070 passed was within the business community, where a lot of leaders there were saying, look, we should have seen this coming. We should have done something about this because the results from a business perspective have not been good. And since then, you saw the business community come out against SB 1062. You've seen them, the business community basically say, look, we should be done with immigration bills after SB 1070 passed. Is this becoming more of a thing now where businesses and companies in a given state are trying to get more involved in policy like this?
I think in certain situations, I mean, obviously what's going on with North Carolina, a lot of businesses are really taking the stand to say, hey, we're not going to participate in a state that has these views. And as far as Arizona goes, you know, like I said, because our current governor is such a pro-business governor, in some ways that the business community is kind of backing that up. As of yet, there hasn't been any major stand in the last year or two, politically speaking, where the business community says, hey, we need to stop this. And perhaps that is because of the strides that the governor's office has taken. But I think it is changing right now, where organizations are saying, we're going to take a stand and we're going to kind of support the community.
Stephen Totten is a reporter with the Phoenix Business Journal. Stephen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The region's only current pro soccer franchise, the Arizona United, is finishing up its season in Peoria this month. But it's been a tumultuous year for the team and its fans as they try to attract a diverse new following in the West Valley.
As the show's Phil Latzman reports, the controversy surrounds the United's former owner over his support of Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump and proves sports and politics often don't mix.
Viso Vasquez is a blogger who covers Mexican and Western soccer for the website footmexsource.com. Late last month, he was watching his Twitter feed when the owner of the Arizona United, Kyle Eng, sent a picture of himself at a Trump rally with vice presidential nominee Mike Pence. Vasquez quickly retweeted it.
With the headline, you know, Arizona United CEO founder, you know, supports Pence and Trump and uses Trump winning team and Trump train as a hashtag.
The reaction to his retweet was swift and negative from the Latino fan base that supported the United.
It wasn't good that the owner that they support is specifically supporting a candidate that has said so many bad things about Mexicans and specifically immigrants.
Marco Medina was one of them.
We felt betrayed.
Medina leads a supporter group called La Hermandad that shows up at all the games trying to rally the team and recruit new soccer fans to help the struggling franchise.
La Hermandad has basically been doing its own outreach within the community. You know, we've been going to the community soccer games, the soccer tournaments, and basically just reaching out saying, hey, you know, have you heard of Arizona United? You know, would you go?
And Medina says his group was offended.
When you have an individual that associates himself with someone like Donald Trump, his face now becomes tied with the club, which, you know, for our community, there's quite a bit of animosity for.
Vasquez says separating soccer from politics is difficult, especially for the group of fans that read his blog, and that Trump's name is a lightning rod to them.
This candidate, you know, this type of political fight that's happening is very, very personal to people, especially the Mexican community.
Then something completely unexpected happened.
When the tweets came out and the controversy, the team contacted a few members of the media that cover Arizona United and said, hey, we do have an announcement scheduled for tomorrow.
That announcement was that the United's principal owner, Kyle Eng, the man pictured in the tweet supporting the Trump-Pence ticket, was selling his stake in the team.
This little tweet controversy happened probably 2-3 weeks after we had already agreed and were able to negotiate the sale of my shares. One had nothing to do with the other.
But fans of the United did not know at the time, and Vasquez says Ang showed no remorse for offending his fan base.
Didn't take it down, didn't think I'm sorry, didn't say anything, you know what, sorry if I offended anyone with it. That's where it kind of goes, and even more, fought with his own fans. Because at that moment, he was still, no one knew that there was going to be a change. He was still the CEO.
Ang, who owns a West Valley advertising and marketing firm, says he didn't have to do any of that, and maintains his support for Trump and says it should have nothing to do with the team or its fans.
I'm proud to have met Mike Pence. I'm proud to support Donald Trump. If fans feel differently, they feel differently. I don't think you can draw the conclusion just because you support a candidate now they have the right to call me a racist or tell me that I was crapping on the Hispanic community.
But Ang, who is of Asian American descent, says he does regret how it all unfolded.
Do I think I could have maybe worded it differently, sure. If fans got upset, I apologize for them getting upset. But I think an opportunity to express ourselves, that's what social media is for.
Meanwhile, the team's new owners say they'll stay out of politics and stick to soccer. David Farca, who grew up in Mexico, is the Arizona United's new president.
We as a soccer club are not going to take any political stands, and we welcome fans from every side of the aisle.
But Farca says the new ownership group will be more sensitive to the needs of its main fan base.
One of the things that I'm most proud of is my Hispanic heritage, and I think that the club recognizes the tremendous potential that we have within the Hispanic community in Arizona.
And so far, the team's supporters say putting aside politics completely is already making a difference with the United's increasingly diverse fan base. For the show, I'm Phil Latzman in Phoenix.
A typical triathlon, at least the kind we're familiar with, includes long runs, swims, and bike rides. Tonight, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, or SMOCA, is the site for Arizona's first ever art handlers triathlon. Training, no doubt, has been intense, and with me to explain what's going on is Laura Best, the exhibitions manager for SMOCA. Laura, I guess there won't be any painting on a bike or some sort of water event. So what kind of events make up the Art Handlers Triathlon?
It will be a test of stamina, creativity, and precision, but no bikes, no swimming.
So what are the events?
The three events are going to be, the first one will be the Sustained Art Hang. And so this is an event where we will have the art handlers hold up a very heavy framed work of art at eye level while a caricature of a curator barks orders at them, like, 2 inches to the left. No, I said the right. Never mind. I don't want to see that one anyway. And so the people that will outlast the orders will be the winners of that competition.
Okay.
We're going to have a thrift store salon hang. So this is sort of framed prints that we've gathered together from thrift stores that we will be creatively displaying. And so that will be judged on sort of how pleasing those arrangements are to the eye. And then we'll be doing a packing of artwork. And we will, this one is based off the notion that all artwork should be packed to drop 4 feet off of the back of a truck, which is the height of a lift gate. And so we will be dropping them a little bit higher. We'll be taking them up on our scissor lift and dropping these packed art objects from about 12 feet and see who survives.
There's some mystery involved, I imagine, unwrapping it to see what survived, huh?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. So it's based on skill. Is it based on speed as well or no?
It's a little bit based on speed, yeah. Part of all of our jobs as art handlers or preparators, as we're known as, is we're always working under a deadline. There's always an exhibition opening. And so usually that's a week, 2 weeks, if we're really lucky, longer. But all of us know what it's like to work really long hours and have to get stuff done quickly and accurately.
So how many contestants are there?
There are 4 institutions from across the valley participating. There is my museum, SMOCA, Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. We have Phoenix Art Museum, Children's Museum of Phoenix, and Scottsdale Public Art.
So not to bring up some horrible moment from the past, but have you had a moment of any of these three events where you were actually doing them, not as an event, but actually in your job where things didn't work out so well?
Oh, sure. I mean, well, all of us have participated in a sustained art hold, that's for sure, where you've been holding up a piece of art for so long to show the artist or the curator, and, you know, everybody's forearms are shaking. And you need to say, okay, for the safety of this piece, we have to put it down.
Can people actually learn from watching this? Like, if you're, because I think we've all been through the situation at home, certainly not holding it to the point where our arms are shaking, but we really have no idea what looks good. I mean, I have no idea.
I think that seeing professionals do, you know, what they do really confidently and really quickly, there's a lot to be seen there. I don't think that the average person feels really confident when they're hanging a piece of art in their own home or, you know, a family photo. So I think that most people don't know that eye level is generally 60 inches. That's what we hang at in museums and galleries. It can vary a little bit if you want to bring it down lower. But I think that there's a lot that you can observe, and you can maybe even just think about what goes into a normal exhibition, what goes into an arrangement of works on a wall, and what goes into packing and transporting artwork from place to place.
Anything we obviously left out you want to get in?
Well, there's going to be free lemonade the night of the event, and I think that's a really important
plain
thing
or pink?
To continue. I'm not sure.
Because that's...
I'm going to say plain.
Okay. It's free, so not even like a little... Okay.
It's free, right. And there's a cash bar, but free lemonade.
Laura Best, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Laura Best of SMOCA, where tonight's Art Handlers Triathlon will be held.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.